This is stuff you're not supposed to know. This is a series of email questions and answers. The answers provided by the researcher James Montgomery, whose website is right now down as of the time of this recording. That website was atgpress.com, againstthegrainpress.com. It was notable mainly for the critical research work of many years, that of The Informer and James Montgomery. Montgomery's work going under the heading of Knowledge is Freedom. But atgpress.com, the account has been suspended. The site's no longer up. I wonder if that information will somehow be saved. But I had printed up a lot of Montgomery's work, and I want to at least preserve this one. In my previous incarnation, the previous show, The Ministry of Truth, I had read a lot of his work. He's a fantastic researcher. I guess he does not do interviews, this James Montgomery guy. Anyway, I think this article may have gone under the heading of 25 email questions. I don't know if there are exactly 25. There's a lot of them. But these apparently were the most common, some of the most common questions asked of James Montgomery by readers who were either baffled or outraged or shocked when they read what his findings unquestionably prove. So without further ado, here are... Good thing I printed these up. Here are email questions answered by James Montgomery. And this is going to appear, this is going to sound rather disjointed. That's just the way the article was, the way it is. James Montgomery wrote, "I am not going to waste much time in responding to what has been forwarded to me by a man too cowardly to use his real name. I have included a couple of paragraphs of his email to respond to." Or, no, of your email to respond to, someone else's. Okay, begin email quote. "Hello, everyone. For those of you who know me, you know from where I am about to speak. For those of you who do not know me, whether you accept what I have to say, I can only ask that you check me out. For the last few weeks, I have been receiving this email train trying to explain why we are in such a pickle. While I agree this nation is in a pickle, I have found your solutions to be lacking in substance and to be without historical support. I have sat back and watched, but I believe it is time to chime in and let you all know what I have discovered that the government itself knows and understands. Unfortunately, the ideas you have been discussing is what has made the so-called Patriot Movement the laughingstock within the government itself. They know that you are all off base and virtually clueless, and this applies to both James Montgomery and The Informer. I do not know James, but I do know The Informer." End email quote. And here is the rebuttal by James Montgomery. "I wonder if you would believe substance or historical fact. I can wallpaper my walls with historical fact, since that is what The Informer and I base our facts on. The United States is still a British colony, and the 1787 Constitution does not exist. You obviously have not studied our English and American history because, my friend, I did not write it. You, like other Americans, will deny anything that challenges the party line or would upset your world. You make a fool of yourself by your misguided admonishment of the informer and myself. We have clear, unrefutable proof of the facts we have presented to America, knowing so-called patriots like yourself would be quick to attack us personally. I wasn't born very long ago, but it wasn't yesterday. Do you think we woke up one day and said, let's see how we can make everybody in the U.S. mad at us? Or, let's make up this incredible story that will make people respond as you have. Wake up. The sun does not rotate around your world. What about truth, and as you say, historical fact, proven by documents? And not just taking the party line, talking the party line, because that is what I was taught, so I will look no further. Let's look at some facts. I am not going to deal with the British issue, since you have not accepted a more recent historical fact, the death of the 1787 Constitution. 1. The Constitution is a contract or charter between the states creating a corporation called the United States Government. 2. This contract or charter contains the bylaws of the United States concerning its powers or lack of power. If any part of a contract between the creating parties is broken, it dissolves the contract slash charter. 3. The Constitution states clearly enough that even you could not question its intent. Article 4, Section 4, the United States shall guarantee to every state in this Union a republican form of government. 4. If you had studied history, you would know the state governments of the southern states were booted out and unelected governments put in their place so that the 14th Amendment would be ratified. The U.S. government not only denied a republican form of government to the southern states, it removed a republican form of government from them. From this act alone, the 1787 Constitution was dead, and a new Constitution forced on the southern states. 5. Article 5, Section 1. That no state without its consent shall be deprived of its equal suffrage in the Senate. The senators of all southern states were kicked out of the Senate along with the New Jersey senator. 6. Not only was the Constitution ripped to shreds by the above unlawful acts, but this was a political slash military takeover. All of the southern states were Democrat, and the northern states Republican. The action of the northern states destroyed a two-party system, and said, you will not only vote as we say, you will also change your state constitutions to read as we dictate. 7. If this was not enough to destroy the Constitution, these same renegade northern states passed the Reconstruction Acts. These acts were declared unconstitutional by President Johnson, a lawful president. His veto was overridden by an unlawful Congress, an unrepresented government, Because 12 lawful constitutional states were removed by force. A government that no longer had any lawful form, as proven above, was trying to do business outside of the charter that gave it life. 8. I mentioned the senator from New Jersey. He had taken his seat in the Senate and was properly voted in by his state. He was then removed by an unlawful U.S. government only represented by the northern states. 9. The southern states, just before the political takeover, retook their seats in the House and the Senate, voted and ratified the 13th Amendment, proving they were once again lawful parties to oversee the 1787 Constitution, which also proves they had republican forms of government, and that these governments were militarily overthrown. 10. By the above facts, a 1787 constitutional government does not exist today, nor can it. The contract and charter were broken, and a new form of government installed by military force, different from the approved 1787 government. This de facto government still exists today, only by its military powers and martial rule. The action taken by the northern states was a military coup d'etat. I know you want some historical proof, so here it is. If you are man enough to admit that you are wrong, email me with your real name, and I will send you all the historical proof you can handle. Don't accuse the informer or myself in front of others, in an assumed name, of not having proof of what we are saying, or I will assume, as will others, that you are a government employee doing damage control, trying to protect your spineless backside and your paycheck. Historical facts. Can you rebut them or change history? Furthermore, on April 2nd, 1866, President Andrew Johnson issued a proclamation that, quote, "The insurrection which heretofore existed in the states of Georgia, South Carolina, Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Alabama, Louisiana, Arkansas, Mississippi, and Florida is at an end, and is henceforth to be so regarded." Unquote. Veto message of President Johnson, March 2, 1867. Quote, "It is plain that the authority here given to the military officer amounts to absolute despotism. But to make it still more unendurable, the bill provides that it may be delegated to as many subordinates as he chooses to appoint, for it declares that he shall punish or cause to be punished. Such a power has not been wielded by any monarch in England for more than 500 years. This is, by the way, this is Andrew Johnson, his veto message, where he was trying to veto the Reconstruction Acts, and he was noting that the military dictator would have the powers of a feudal monarch, and those were your Reconstruction Acts. Back to the quote. "In all that time, no people who speak the English language have borne such servitude. It reduces the whole population of the 10 states, all persons of every color, sex, and condition, and every stranger within their limits, to the most abject and degrading slavery. No master ever had a control so absolute over the slaves as this bill gives to the military officers over both white and colored persons." Unquote. Quote, "I come now to a question which is, if possible, still more important. Have we the power to establish and carry into execution a measure like this? I answer, certainly not. If we derive our authority from the Constitution, and if we are bound by the limitations which it imposes, unquote. Quote, the United States are bound to guarantee to each state a republican form of government. Can it be pretended that this obligation is not palpably broken if we carry out a measure like this, which wipes away every vestige of republican government in 10 states and puts the life, property, and honor of all people in each of them under the domination of a single person clothed with unlimited authority? Unquote. Quote, here is a bill of attainder against 9 million people at once. It is based upon an accusation so vague as to be scarcely intelligible and found to be true upon no credible evidence. Not one of the 9 million was heard in his own defense. The representatives of the doomed parties were excluded from all participation in the trial. The conviction is to be followed by the most ignominious punishment ever inflicted on large masses of men. It disenfranchises them by hundreds of thousands and degrades them all, even those who are admitted to be guiltless, from the rank of freemen to the condition of slaves. Unquote. More from President Andrew Johnson's veto message of the Reconstruction Acts, March 2, 1867. Quote, as a result of these decisions, enforcement of the Reconstruction Act against the Southern states, helpless to resist military rule without aid of the judiciary, went forward unhampered. Here is a quote about President Johnson's veto message from 1867, and this quote is from the Tulane Law Review, the article entitled The Dubious Origin of the 14th Amendment, page 36. Quote, as a result of these decisions, enforcement of the Reconstruction Act against the Southern states, helpless to resist military rule without aid of the judiciary, went forward unhampered. Puppet governments were founded in these various states under military auspices. Through these means, the adoption of new state constitutions, conforming to the requirements of Congress, was accomplished. Likewise, one by one, these puppet state governments ratified the 14th Amendment, which their more independent predecessors had rejected. Finally, in July 1868, the ratifications of this amendment by the puppet governments of 7 of the 10 Southern states, including Louisiana, gave more than the required ratification by 3/4 of the states and resulted in a joint resolution adopted by Congress and a proclamation by the Secretary of State, both declaring the amendment ratified and in force. Unquote. And this following are more quotes from the same article, The Dubious Origin of the 14th Amendment, in the Tulane Law Review. Quote, despite the fact that the Southern states had been functioning peacefully for 2 years and had been counted to secure ratification of the 13th Amendment, Congress passed the Reconstruction Act, which provided for the military occupation of 10 of the 11 Southern states. It excluded Tennessee from military occupation, and one must suspect it was because Tennessee had ratified the 14th Amendment on July 7, 1866. The act further disenfranchised practically all white voters and provided that no senator or congressman from the occupied, approved by CD states, could be seated in Congress until the new Constitution was adopted by each state which would be Congress. The act further provided that each of the 10 states was required to ratify the proposed 14th Amendment, and the 14th Amendment must become a part of the Constitution of the United States before the military occupancy would cease and the states be allowed to have seats in Congress. The decisions wherein grounds were found for avoiding a rule on the constitutionality of the Reconstruction Act leave the impression that our highest tribunal failed in these cases to measure up to the standard of the judiciary in a constitutional democracy. If the Reconstruction Act was unconstitutional, the people oppressed by it were entitled to protection by the judiciary against such unconstitutional representation. The adversary or the skeptic might assert that, after a lapse of more than 80 years, it is too late to question the constitutionality or validity of the coerced ratifications of the 14th Amendment, even on substantial and serious grounds. The ready answer is that there is no statute of limitations that will cure a gross violation of the amendment procedure laid down by Article 5 of the Constitution, unquote. And apparently, in the court case Dyett versus Turner, D-Y-E-T-T, there is more information corroborating this. The following is an excerpt from Joint Resolution No. 1 of the State of New Jersey of March 24, 1868, when they rescinded their prior ratification and rejected the 14th Amendment. Quote, "It being necessary by the Constitution that every amendment to the same should be proposed by two-thirds of both houses of Congress, the authors of said proposition, for the purpose of securing the assent of the requisite majority, determined to and did exclude from the said two houses 80 representatives from 11 states of the Union upon the pretense that there were no such states in the Union. But finding that two-thirds of the remainder of the said houses could not be brought to assent to the said proposition, they deliberately formed and carried out the design of mutilating the integrity of the United States Senate, and without any pretext or justification other than the possession of power, without the right and in palpable violation of the Constitution, they ejected a member of their own body representing this state, and thus practically denied to New Jersey its equal suffrage in the Senate, and thereby nominally secured the vote of two-thirds of the said houses." Unquote. Quote, "The object of dismembering the highest representative assembly in the nation and humiliating a state of the Union faithful at all times to all of its obligations, and the object of said amendment were, one, they were to place new and unheard powers in the hands of a faction, that it might absorb to itself all executive, judicial, and legislative power necessary to secure to itself immunity for the unconstitutional acts it had already committed, and those it has since inflicted on a too patient people." Unquote. Quote, "The subsequent usurpation of these once national assemblies in passing pretended laws for the establishment in 10 states of martial law, which is nothing but the will of the military commander, and therefore inconsistent with the very nature of all law, for the purpose of reducing to slavery men of their own race to those states, or compelling them, contrary to their own convictions, to exercise the elective franchise in obedience to dictation of a fraction in those assemblies, the attempt to commit to one man arbitrary and uncontrolled power, which they have found necessary to exercise to force the people of those states into compliance with their will, the authority given to the Secretary of War to use the name of the President to countermand its President's order and to certify military orders to be by the direction of the President when they are notoriously known to be contrary to the President's direction. You'll wonder why Johnson almost got impeached. You had a renegade outlaw rump Northern Congress that was doing its own thing. Back to the quote. Thus keeping up the forms of the Constitution to which the people are accustomed. That sounds familiar. But practically deposing the President from his office of Commander-in-Chief and suppressing one of the great departments of the government, that of the executive, the attempt to withdraw from the supreme judicial tribunal of the nation the jurisdiction to examine and decide upon the conformity of their pretended laws to the Constitution, which was the chief function of that august tribunal, as organized by the fathers of the Republic, all are but amplified explanations of the power they hope to acquire by the adoption of the said amendment. Unquote. To conceal from the people the immense alteration of the fundamental law they intended to accomplish by the said amendment, they gilded the same with propositions of justice. Unquote. Quote, it imposes new prohibitions upon the power of the state to pass laws and interdicts the execution of such part of the common law as the national judiciary may esteem inconsistent with the vague provisions of the said amendment, made vague for the purpose of facilitating encroachment upon the lives, liberties, and property of the people. Unquote. Quote, it enlarges the judicial power of the United States so as to bring every law passed by the state and every principle of the common law relating to life, liberty, or property within the jurisdiction of the federal tribunals, and charges those tribunals with duties to the due performance of which they, from their nature and organization, and their distance from the people, are unequal. Unquote. Quote, it makes a new apportionment of representatives in the national courts, for no other reason than thereby to secure to a faction a sufficient number of votes of a servile and ignorant race to outweigh the intelligent voices of their own. Unquote. And the following quote is from an article called The 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States and the Threat That It Poses to Our Democratic Government by Pinckney McElwee from the South Carolina Law Quarterly, 1959. Quote, this legislature, feeling conscious of the support of the largest majority of the people that has ever been given expression to the public will, declare that the said proposed amendment being designed to confer or to compel the states to confer the sovereign right of elective franchise upon a race which has never given the slightest evidence at any time or in any quarter of the globe of its capacity of self-government, and erect an impracticable standard of suffrage which will render the right valueless to any portion of the people, was intended to overthrow the system of self-government under which the people of the United States have, for 80 years, enjoyed their liberties, and is unfit from its origin, its object, and its matter, to be incorporated with the fundamental law of a free people. Unquote. All right, here's a new email. And this email was apparently addressed to the informer. "Hey, Al, just got back from deer hunting, sitting on the side of a tree, 30 feet in the air. It is a great place to think. I remembered a quote I was wanting to tell you about. In the book Pete sent us, there is a quote that leaves no doubt as to who George Washington was loyal to. The book is Ingersoll, North American Review, CLV, number 2, August 1892, page 183. It's also a quote in Sources of the Constitution of the United States by C. Ellis Stevens, 1927, page 36. Here is the quote. Quote, "In May 1775, Washington said, 'If you ever hear of me joining in any such measure as separation from Great Britain, you have my leave to set me down for everything wicked.'" Unquote. He also said, quote, "It is not wish or interest of the government," meaning Massachusetts, "or of any other upon this continent, separately or collectively, to set up for independence," unquote. In reading the messages and papers of the presidents, volume 1, 1789 to 1897, I discover the following. Quote, "Gentlemen of the Senate, pursuant to the powers vested in me by the act entitled An Act Repealing After the Last Day of June, next, the duties heretofore laid upon distilled spirits imported from abroad, and laying others in their stead, and also upon spirits distilled within the United States, and for appropriating the same, I have thought fit to divide the United States into the following districts." Bingo. There you go, George Washington, overlaying the geographical states of the Union with legal fictitious states, district states. "I have thought fit to divide the United States into the following districts." Wonderful, wonderful lawyerly trick. Namely, the District of New Hampshire, to consist of the State of New Hampshire, the District of Massachusetts, to consist of the State of Massachusetts, the District of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations, to consist of the State of Rhode Island and Providence Plantations, the District of Connecticut, to consist of the State of Connecticut, the District of Vermont, to consist of the State of Vermont, the District of New York, to consist of the State of New York, the District of New Jersey, to consist of the State of New Jersey, the District of Pennsylvania, to consist of the State of Pennsylvania, the District of Delaware, to consist of the State of Delaware, the District of Maryland, to consist of the State of Maryland, the District of Virginia, to consist of the State of Virginia, the District of North Carolina, to consist of the State of North Carolina, the District of South Carolina, to consist of the State of South Carolina, the District of Georgia, to consist of the State of Georgia. Page 99, March 4th, 1791. Messages and Papers of the Presidents. Unquote. In George Washington's proclamation of March 30th, 1791, he declares the District of Columbia to be created and its borders established. He says further, "And Congress, by an amendatory act passed on the third day of the present month of March, have given further authority to the President of the United States." This explains completely why, after a short time in office, Washington created federal district states for all the geographic states. The point being, Congress outside their authority, extended and gave monarchical powers, powers to the President of the United States in violation of the spirit of the Constitution and the Tenth Amendment. One day after George Washington is given this authority, he declares the states are now controlled by the district state. This makes the state courts, marshals, right down to the counties, subject to the federal government, because the district state was an overlay of state boundaries. It removed the state borders in violation of the Constitution, wherein it is declared the state are guaranteed a republican form of government. Creation of the district states was and is a violation of the 1787 Constitution of the United States and the trust it created. This replaced the states in the Union with the district states in Union, formerly known as the states of fill in the blank. This was also necessary for the newly formed, you guessed it, Bank of the United States, February 25th, 1791, to do business in the state of fill in the blank, but is actually the district state. Subjection of the states of blank was complete. All that was necessary was for a permanent state of war to exist, such as we have had since the war between the states, to invoke statutory law over the enemy, requiring them to obey all license requirements, because enemies have no rights in an occupied territory. Are you guys catching this? George Washington was a deceitful snake in the grass. Deal with it. Take your mythology, stick it where the sun doesn't shine. That's religion. That's worse yet, it's religion of worshiping men, worshiping its ancestor worship. Knock it off. Trust no man, Scripture says, right? That includes George Washington. Washington declared, under the war powers, acting as commander-in-chief, that the states of the Union were now overlaid by district states, which, as I think you know, removes the state boundaries as a matter of sovereignty, violating the constitutional guarantee of a republican form of government to the states in the Union, in Article 4, Section 4, which cannot take place if delegated authority is taken under the war powers not ceded by the Charter/Constitution. The Constitution granted legislative authority to Congress only over a 10-square-mile district, making Congress the supreme authority. Article 1, Section 1, Section 8.18, over the district. Washington extended this district without constitutional authority. This is how Congress, under Article 1, Section 8.1, taxes everything. This is why the courts have said that the 16th Amendment created no new taxing power. Also, the counties and the sheriffs became subject to and creations of the district states. Washington put in place officers of the district to oversee the state districts. As a result of the military rule imposed way back when by George Washington himself, a tax was imposed on liquor, and under direction of Washington, the district courts and appeals courts were ordered to enforce collection and fines and imprisonment of anyone defying the laws of the United States. And guess what, folks?
these districts created by George Washington have never been removed. Moving on to a new email here, it looks like. Again, this package of emails from James Montgomery, it's kind of disjointed in its assembly. But if you can get past the very loose organization, there is some really choice and rare knowledge here. All right, next one. In response that the Anglo-Saxon common law was left out of the informer's question, is as follows. Oof, garbled syntax there. And I do not answer for him, but this is in addition to his response. Britain was first invaded by 55 BC by Julius Caesar, and then again in 54 BC. In 63 AD, Joseph of Arimathea was sent by the Pope in Rome to try and establish the Catholic Church in Britain. In 77 AD, Britain was taken over through conquest by Rome. The imperial... Boy, that doesn't sound right. 63 AD, Catholic Church in Britain? Yeah, maybe. No, that's not right. That's a bad date there. Something's wrong with that. Anyway, 77 AD, Britain was taken over through conquest by Rome. The imperial governor, Julius Agricola, was put in place to rule over Rome's new territory. Britain was, as of 77 AD, subject to Rome with Roman law. In 407 AD, Emperor Constantine III withdrew the Roman troops from Britain, leaving a political vacuum. The Celts, Irish, and the Vikings, Scandinavians, saw an opening to obtain land. In 410 AD, Britain won its independence from Rome when the Goths ransacked Rome. In 446 AD, the British government sought help to defeat the invading arms of the northern countries. Rome was unable to send troops because it was defending itself from Attila the Hun. So Rome offered mercenaries to aid Britain. Britain hired these barbaric mercenaries, which were from northern Germany, and we know them today as the Saxons. In 450 AD, the Saxon barbarians began to massacre the Britons and take their land. In this manner, they occupied the country of Britain. The Saxons were pagans. Some believed the Druid religion. Others worshipped the same gods Rome worshipped, Mercury, Venus, etc. The long and short of it is the Saxons were not responsible for a common law by themselves. They were not Christians and did not support canon or ecclesiastical law, and their law was influenced greatly by Roman law. Boy, that this is not going to sit well with the British Israelites, is it? Continuing. The major difference was the Saxon king called himself King of the English, and William the Conqueror, who was to come a little later, called himself King of England, meaning William the Conqueror claimed he owned the land, and the Saxon king made no such claims. Imagine that. Although, again, to... Boy, those British Israelites, they do make a good point there. Because the kingship, the dynasty of kings in ancient Israel, They never claimed to own the land. The people owned their own land. It's only later on, and in different, more pagan cultures, do we get kings claiming totalitarian control of all the land. Under Saxon law, citizen meant free man, and under Roman law, continuing in England after 1066 under William the Conqueror, citizen meant subject. There you go, folks. To a Saxon, citizen meant free man. To a Norman, citizen meant subject. That's the difference. And that's the difference between Old Testament citizen and the citizen of today also. Under both systems, you were forced to pay taxes to support the government. A taxpayer is always a subject. So under William the Conqueror, no doubt was left as to your status. But the Saxon kings were more subtle. Nevertheless, the outcome is the same. Taxation and subjection, it confirms, is not always a bad thing. It depends on the government. Case in point, those that are Christians are subject to Jesus Christ and are taxed 10% to support his government. I guess he's deriving that from the Old Testament tithing, I suppose. Continuing, look at what happened at Runnymede with the Magna Carta. The barons thought they were gaining freedom by the king granting them rights under the Carta. However, if they had stopped to read the 1213 Carta, wherein the king had already granted and ceded to the Pope all of his lands, they would have known the king could not grant the rights without the blessing of the Pope. Did not the Pope sign off on the Carta of 1215 as a party to the contract? Ask yourself this. Did the granted rights end their tax obligations to the king or the Pope? No. So, is the granting of rights a problem or a hindrance to the moneylenders? No. Did the 1215 Carta in any way overturn the obligations of the 1213 Carta? No, and they could not. Here is another reason. Guess what, America, and the rest of the free world, that claim that their rights come from the Magna Carta, which was ratified by Pope Innocent III and, of course, the king under duress on June 15th, 1215. On August 24th, 1215, Pope Innocent III declared that the Magna Carta was null and void, just what you expect a pope to do. August 24th, 1215. Oh, this is from the author is Geary. August 24th, 1215. Parliamentary Origins in England, Internet Medieval Sourcebook. I just found this. I do not have a copy of the above declaration at this time. It has been copyrighted. The book will have to be purchased if it is still available. I won't speculate as to why it is kept in copyright and not released to the public, as most other medieval documents have been. Well, you just did speculate. Come on, let's be honest. To continue, Edward I in 1297 was forced to redeclare the 1215 Magna Carta because the Pope forbid his monks and bishops, etc., to pay taxes to the king. So the king began to tax the barons again, and they drew their swords. King Edward, his action holds less weight than that of his predecessor, King John, because as of August 24, 1215, the Carta was an invalid document, not to mention the issue I raised earlier concerning debt obligations of a previous charter that could not be voided. The Pope, by his confirmation of the Magna Carta, was jerking the chains of the barons, so to speak. As I said in earlier papers, there was no way the Pope would give up what was granted, / ceded, to him in the 1213 Charter. The Magna Carta could not void an earlier charter which contained a debt obligation between parties without all parties agreeing on the subsequent one. Since the parties of the 1213 Charter would continue to be born, it was an irrevocable trust. As example, read the 1689 Declaration of Rights, which became law. Did it, or could it, overturn any financial obligations under previous charters? No. Read the third section of the 1689 Declaration of Rights. It says, if any provision of the Declaration comes into conflict with earlier charters, the Declaration will be as if it were never written. If you do not have a copy of all of the above-cited material, let the informer or I know, and we can supply you with the relevant material. Well, now that your website's down, I don't think that deal's good anymore, right, James Montgomery? Do you see how not only Americans, but the entire world have been conned into thinking we are free? Every time the king has been challenged, the king grants rights to the combatants, and they go home saying, "We won!" However, nothing has changed, because the king retained his power to tax through previous charters, and new tax obligations created by accepting the king's benefits. More garbled syntax there. Let me read that again. Through previous charters and new tax obligations created by accepting the king's benefits. Okay, I read that wrong. My bad. Another example. The Declaration of Independence and the War of Independence that followed is no different than any other time in the history in challenging the king. The king said, "Okay, I will grant my created corporations, the states, independence and allow them to establish their own governments. But wait, the governors retained the power granted by the king and the Council of State. The states then consolidated their corporate charters under one charter called the U.S. Constitution. Could the tax obligations of previous charters be removed by our Declaration of Independence, or a war which did not remove the control of the king?" Which is obvious, since in the peace treaty of Paris, the king was granting us the land. No. Nowhere in the 1783 Paris peace treaty will you find granted rights to the inhabitants of the states. Nowhere in the treaty will you find where the taxes of gold, silver, and copper, and other mineral rights were ceded to the states. So much for allodial title in the states. Free man status and allodial title are synonymous. You can't have one without the other. This goes back to Saxon law again, huh? Versus Norman law. Since the king did not cede all of his corporate enterprise, he retained his taxation and the subjection of those that enjoy his benefits. The following is a quote from the Carolina Charter, 1663, regarding the Feast of All Saints, which occurred November 1st of each year. Quote, "Yielding and paying yearly to us, our heirs and successors, for the same, the yearly rent of 20 marks of lawful money of England, at the Feast of All Saints, yearly, for ever. The first payment thereof to begin and be made on the Feast of All Saints, which shall be in the year of our Lord, 1665, and also the fourth part of all gold and silver ore, which, with the limits aforesaid, shall, from time to time, happen to be found. Unquote. More quotes from the Carolina Charter of 1663. Quote, saving always the faith, allegiance, and sovereign dominion due to us, our heirs and successors for the same, and saving also the right, title, and interest of all, and every our subjects of the English nation which are now planted within the limits, bounds aforesaid, if any be, unquote. Quote, know ye that we, of our further grace, certain knowledge and mere motion, have thought fit to erect the same tract of ground, country, and island into a province, and out of the fullness of our royal power and prerogative, we do for us, our heirs and successors, erect, incorporate, and ordain the same into a province, and do call it the province of Carolina. And so from henceforth we will have it called. End quote. And we will close up with a final paragraph, the words of James Montgomery. For this part of email questions answered by him. Montgomery writes, nothing has changed. The parties of interest still rule. It is our pitiful lack of knowledge and understanding of history which causes us to hang our hats, our independence, on documents that maintain and did not change our subjection. Does this sound familiar to what has happened to the blacks? They assumed, since they were made citizens and given more rights, that they were now free. As you know, a 14th Amendment citizen is subject to its creator, who granted their rights, the corporation and the trustees, subject to the contracting parties, the crown and the pope. Maybe now you know why history repeats itself. It is because it has the same authors. Signed, James Montgomery, sui juris servant of Jesus Christ. This concludes part one of Email Questions Answered by James Montgomery.